Welcome to Everything But The Tip, the podcast that bucks the trend of the mainstream golf content being churned out by the masses. Presented by the co-founders of Smart Golf and Fitness, we're on a mission to guide golfers towards genuine improvement. No swing tips, no shortcuts, we're anti-instant gratification. Join us as we navigate the complexities of the game, offering insights on how to truly excel in golf by embracing the challenges and breaking free from the usual quick fix mentality. All right, welcome back as we embark on another episode of Everything But The Tip. I'm your co-host, Joe Sharon, and today we're delving into the controversial topic of talent and why it may be overrated. As we discuss the topic, we will make reference to the book, Talent is Overrated, written by Jeff Colvin, while specifically covering the concept of deliberate practice. Joining me, as always, is my co-host, co-founder, and chief fitness officer, Tommy Asuma, and our newly appointed director of instruction of our Northbrook location, PGA professional, Kyle Pekka.
Thank you.
Hey, guys, welcome to the show. I'm really excited about this subject.
Hey, I'm happy to be here. We've got a lot to cover tonight, so we should probably get right into it. Talking about talent, it's not uncommon to hear about how world-class performers in any discipline, you know, golf is what we're going to talk about tonight because that's what Smart Golf and Fitness is all about, are just more talented than the people that they're competing against. So Kyle has to be a pretty talented golf instructor to get that that nice promotion there. Looking forward to get the Northbrook location up and running.
Oh, I'm very excited for that.
Excellent. So we're excited to have you there. But let's get right into it. And what exactly do we mean by talent?
Yeah, I think to aid in this conversation, we 100% have to come to an agreement on how we define what talent is. And we're basically going to use a very simple dictionary definition. And, you know, talent is typically seen as an innate ability to excel in a particular activity without much effort. Some might call it a gift. And I think the key word here is innate, something that you're either born with or you're not. And I think it's highly debatable. So the one thing I do want to point out is I do think there are a lot of coaches out there because, you know, I've been in the room with them, I've seen presentations, and they believe with this notion. And they simply say, you know, some of your students, they just got it, and some don't. Some are cats, and some are dogs. and if you don't know what I mean by that, it's like if you hold a cat upside down by their legs, and you let them go, what are they going to do? Well, they're going to land on their feet. Well, you do the same thing with a dog, what's going to happen?
Not looking good.
Exactly. So, I want to unpack today.
Sorry for those PETA folks out there that might be listening to this golf podcast. No dogs were harmed in the filming or recording of this episode.
So there's the book that we referenced in the intro. It's the book titled Talent is Overrated. By the way, it is a must read for anyone that is highly interested in maximizing their ability in any discipline. But I think this book uncovers a plethora of evidence that 100% disputes the notion that talent is going to be the biggest separator. Again, not saying that it doesn't necessarily exist, which we'll talk more about, but it does a really good job explaining that there's more evidence saying that there are other objective reasons why people have become world-class in their discipline. So the book does a really good job at making a very solid case that above genetics, age, intelligence, experience, and really any other trait, nothing is more impactful than what they call deliberate practice.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, you know, we're supposed to believe the fact that, like, you know, prodigies like the GOAT, Tiger Woods, was not born with an innate ability to excel at golf?
Well, I'm glad that you brought that up, because this book actually has an entire chapter devoted to Tiger and Mozart, because that is a very quick knee-jerk reaction for the people that are going to defend that those individuals were just more talented, right? And it's fair. Those guys accomplished more throughout their careers than arguably anyone else in that discipline, at least in that time period. Right. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about what the book, the facts in which the book uncovered. And there's actually a lot of parallels between Mozart and
the composer?
Tiger Woods. Yes.
Okay. Cool. Okay. Just making sure we're talking about the right Mozart. That's all.
Correct. So I think number one, I think Mozart, when people think of him, if they know anything about him, he was famously known for, you know, composing music at the young age of five. He was performing live as a pianist and violinist at the age of eight. I think just hearing that out loud, your knee-jerk reaction is, holy smokes. Well, number one, let's look at my kids. Can I picture any one of them standing a chance at accomplishing any of that? And, well, in my case, unfortunately, the answer no is no. But as you start to dive a little bit further into it, you got to look at, number one, who his father was. And his name was Leopold Mozart. And he, in his own right, was a very accomplished composer and musician. So number one, Mozart was born into a family with a father that had a deep history in that field. Okay, so we got to take that into consideration. Number two, he was known to be a very domineering. You know, also known as a pedagogue. He was a very, very strict teacher, right? And he had a very strong interest in doing so, okay? So in addition to that, he 100% had a deep interest in teaching children. So you have to take that into consideration, right? That's the whole nature versus nurture argument. I can't say I know a lot of individuals, I can't, but that were born into that exact situation. But there are some very valid arguments and evidence made there that show why Mozart was positioned to excel at such a young age in his life and ultimately go on to what he accomplished. Would you guys agree with that?
100%. And I'm sure we'll touch on this again later. But it all kind of goes back to like that 10,000 hours rule where all of these people are positioned where they have an opportunity to do the thing that they eventually excel at just a much higher rate than the average person.
Yeah, 100%. And we are definitely going to be discussing, not in super depth, but I think that's a concept, the 10,000-hour rule, that goes along with exactly what we're talking about. So I think, we definitely need to discuss that. So I just want to fast forward this point here, and I want to move forward into Tiger, right? Because that's what the initial question was. You're trying to tell me that Tiger Woods wasn't this innate talent?
So you said.
Well, we got to look at his situation. And again, like I said, there were some parallels. You got to look at his father, right? You got
to start. Was he born to a pedagogue?
Some would say yes. Yeah, some would say yes as far as, Earl spent half his career in the military, right? So take that into consideration. In the military, part of his career was teaching young cadets. He'd teach them, you know, tactics. He would teach them war games, et cetera. I'm not going to pretend like I'm an expert on there, but I know that he had a history in teaching cadets. In the military, right? So I think you also got to take into consideration that his dad was an accomplished baseball player. I think we all know he played at Kansas State, and he was a standout baseball player there. I think it's also known that he had always had a lifelong passion for sports, right? So now we're just adding to a list. We're adding to a list of ingredients, okay? Now, fast forward, after he retires from the military, okay, he became extremely fanatical about golf, like obsessed. And to the point to where he actually, if I remember correctly, he actually became, you know, a single digit golfer, maybe low single digit in a really short time period, you know, a couple of years, because, you know, he put a lot of time, he became obsessed with it. So now, fast forward, Tiger's born. Yes, I believe Earl had three kids from a previous marriage, now divorced, but they were grown. So we're not going there. So Tiger was virtually born as a single child, right? And I think that's so important to note, because although there are pros and cons to being a single child, I think we all can agree with that, being parents of our own. But I would say the biggest pro is that if you have a single child, what do they get?
A lot more time and attention, I would imagine.
100% undivided attention. So, well, we all know the story. What did Earl do? Well, as soon as Tiger was born, he was put in a high chair. And we all know the famous story. Earl put him in a high chair, went to the garage, and what did he do? He selfishly beat ball for 2 hours and made his kid watch. Right? It was like a movie, just a reel. On and on and on. What were you going to say?
This is like my lessons. This is the 20 minutes where you watch me hit balls.
Hey, you got to demonstrate what it's supposed to look like, right? So, all right, so you got to take that into consideration. So there he is as a kid in a high chair watching his dad beat balls, supposedly every day on a regular basis. In addition to that, before Tiger, I mean, when he was 7 months, he got his first golf club. Okay. And then by the age of two, it was known to that him and his father were regularly showing up to the golf course to practice and play at two. That's great. Now, I will say I did have my kid, you know, hitting a golf club at one, you know, right when he could. He wasn't quite two. But you know, call it maybe a little bit of envy. Call it that I've chosen to be a parent versus a coach to my child. There's, you know, I have my reasons, but yes, you know, my oldest son, Oakley, we had two other kids. When that happened, yeah, I had this like initial dream that I was going to not necessarily Tiger Woods him, but you know, who does that? But I definitely was looking forward to taking all of my knowledge, all of my passion, all of my resources. And I'm not saying I've thrown in the towel, but I can tell you at his age right now, you know, he's not on the same timeline as Tiger. So the point is, when the Tiger finally hit the age of 11, you guys remember how many trophies he won?
It was only like over 100, no?
113. Now, people, be honest with yourself. I would imagine most of our listeners, most, probably hadn't even played 113 rounds of golf by that age. Now, maybe I'm wrong. I'm sure a few of you can say, no, I did. But the point is that he had played not only 113 tournaments, he had won that many. So we know he played a lot more. The whole picture I'm trying to paint is that there's, when you really start to dive deep into all world-class performers, yes, we cherry-picked a couple, but you dive deep into their histories, you can really draw some solid lines and objectively see why they were so successful.
Yeah, it sounds like they had a lot of experience in those particular disciplines early on. So, you know, I mean, what about the amount of experience? I mean, that's a pretty important part of the equation, it sounds like. Experience, hard work, have to be some pretty powerful reasons of why people get extremely good at what they do.
Yeah, so you're saying length of time participating with a particular activity?
Yeah, you said both of these guys got started really, really early. So they had a ton of experience at a very young age, a ton of exposure to these particular disciplines. So I would suspect that amount of experience plays a pretty significant role.
Yeah, I think that is a really good observation. But you know, believe it or not, the amount of experience doesn't necessarily determine the level of success. We're going to dive deeper into why that is. Length of experience actually has little correlation to skill, believe it or not. Look, so here's an example. This is a cherry-picked one. I think I probably got this from the book. But if a chef makes a bowl of shitty soup, right?
I'm not going to that restaurant anymore.
Well, fine. Okay, I didn't say he was successful. He just called himself a chef. Point is, if the individual makes the same shitty bowl of soup, but he does it for 20 years, he had a lot of experience, didn't he? 20 years of it.
Yeah.
Why wasn't he world-class in that bowl of soup?
Because it wasn't any good.
That you can draw a parallel to the same golf professional given the same lesson for all 20 years of his career. And I'll be honest, when I look at a resume and I see that you've been in the industry for 10, 20, 30 years, I don't automatically look at that as a positive. In some ways, that's a negative. You know, if you haven't been continuously upgrading, continuously going to, you know, surrounding yourself with people that are in the field, you know, maybe smarter than you, maybe not, maybe going to educational events, reading more books, trying new drills, trying new training aids. Well, you're not evolving. You're not getting better. And I'm giving a little bit of a sneak preview of what is in addition to the amount of time and experience that it takes to get better. But just because you've been doing something for a really long time doesn't automatically mean you're getting better at it.
Yeah. I mean, everybody always uses that phrase, practice makes perfect. But I mean, practice makes permanent. So if you're practicing something that's not on the right path, then you're just making, you know, the inroads on something that we really don't want to be doing long term.
Like perfect practice makes perfect.
Perfect practice makes perfect.
I love that, and that's spot on, and that summarizes exactly what I just discussed perfectly.
It's perfect.
Perfect practice. All right.
So, I mean, we came out of the episode to talk about deliberate practice, right? So, you know, we've talked about experience. We talked about early exposure. We talked about just recently about just having more experience and more practice, you know, doesn't necessarily make you better, doesn't make you world class. So should probably start to, you know, talk to the audience a little bit, let them in on, you know, what exactly is deliberate practice? What does it consist of?
Yes, thank you. And I was just going to say, although experience plays a role, it ultimately comes down to the type of experience, and you beat me to the punch, and that type of experience, yes, is called deliberate practice. And yeah, I do want to unpack that a little bit. So the term deliberate practice was actually popularized by a guy named, he was a psychologist named Anders Ericsson. He was also, there was a book written by Malcolm Gladwell. Thank you. And, you know, he also wrote the book Outliers, and that's where we'll talk about the 10,000-hour rule here in a minute. But basically, the psychologist Anders Ericsson and his colleagues, you know, they were researchers, and they were looking deep into expertise and skill acquisition. Okay, so I don't know if he actually coined deliberate practice, but through his research and studies, that's ultimately what they moved forward with in describing what they found. So an oversimplification of what deliberate practice is number one, it's you gotta identify what you're bad at, right? That's number one. And two, specifically, you need to specifically design training, okay, to help improve that. And then finally, number three, you need to spend a ton of time working on it through high repetition and successive refinement. So that's a simplification of deliberate practice.
I didn't bring my swim cap today, but I thought we were going to like actually dive deep into deliberate practice and not oversimplify it. I thought we were going to like fully unpack that concept today. So I thought there were five elements that kind of made up deliberate practice. And I thought we were going to actually like get into those five elements today. Are we not?
Of course. Let's do it. All right. So number one, as stated, it's an activity specifically designed to improve performance. And the key here is ideally, it's designed by an expert in the field, designed by a coach.
Yeah, I mean, I've run into so many people, and I'm sure everybody has, that says, I know what I need to do, I just can't do it. And I mean, if that were really the case, and you actually knew what to do, and you put in the effort towards making that change, you'd probably be able to do it by this point. So that is where it's time to, you know, call in the reliever, find an expert, and, you know, get put on the right path.
Right, but what exactly does that mean? What does that look like in a lesson to have, you know, an activity that's specifically tailored?
Yeah, so like, as he said, you know, that is a funny comment because it's so cliche, but you have to truly be correct in what you're identifying. You have to identify what's truly bad, why it's bad. What's the direction we need to go in order to improve that? Right. We won't go super deep down this, but it's like in golf, you hear other instructors say it all the time. I believe Book Charman was the first, but it's like you want to find the cancer. So if you're going to isolate that and specifically work on that, what is bad, hopefully it has a domino effect on things that come, you know, that are also a, you know, negatively impacted due to that swing flaw in the first place. But so to answer your question, you know, let's just use a golf instruction, for example. So if we're looking at a common swing flaw in the golf industry, it's called sway. Right? So go ahead and paint the picture for our listeners.
That's the excessive lateral movement into the backswing. So many of you have been to a lesson before, perhaps, and your instructor drew that line along that trail hip there and wanted you to stay inside of that line. That's what a sway looks like there, just moving excessively into the backswing, into that trail leg.
Yeah, and I think the key word, again, is excessive. And a lot of what we talk about here at SmartGolf and a lot of our job here, and it falls in line with our philosophy, is we're trying to get rid of unnecessary and excessive movement, unnecessary and extra variables. We're trying to solidify and develop the patterns that are going to give you the best possible chance to have the swing that's easiest for you to repeat. But the end goal is, yes, we want to get rid of excessive motion. So yes, looking at sway, excessive lateral hip motion away from the target. All right, so we've identified what we want to go after. That's what we've identified. That's what we're saying that you're bad at. So step one, we have to specifically design a plan of attack to address that issue. And one word I left out in the bigger description of step one is they talk about isolation. Once you've identified what you're bad at, once you've designed the specific activity that you're going to use to address it, you want to isolate it. You want to work at as little at once in the beginning, right? You want to work on that one particular specific objective by itself. So it has all of your brain power. And that's where it becomes back, goes back to what I said earlier. Hopefully you're going and choosing the root of it, the original cancer, because once you've isolated that, only worked on it, on that at once, it has a positive effect on the rest. So okay. Here's the specific activity. I know you're getting there, right?
Oh, sorry.
Okay. Yes, I tend to be long-winded. But if we start to look at the activity, for me, I have a plethora of drills and exercises. You know, one obvious one is, hey, let's have a guy stand next to a wall. Let's grab a little foam ball. We'll actually put it on the lead hip and have him use his hip to keep the ball connected to the wall, right? And then we'll have him do an exercise, arms across the chest. He'll do some shoulder turns. He'll rotate internally into the trail hip. And the objective is not to let the ball fall, right? And we're jumping to another bullet point, but that's the feedback, right? Like, I'm not going to go super deep into that, but if the ball were to fall,
he must be swaying.
He must be swaying. Now, we'll jump to another one. I just, as a whole, I'll just say, like, I love live video. That's one of my favorite training aids. That's one of my favorite tools when it comes to designing specific activities. So for those that might not be familiar with live video, and let's say we're working on sway, I can have a player set up to the golf ball, and I can just turn the camera on live. So whatever movements he's making, he can look at the monitor in front of him and see himself in real time. So then we'll draw a line outside of the trail hip. He's already been exposed to what it's not supposed to look like. We've demonstrated what it is supposed to look like. And what's really powerful about that form of feedback is in the moment when he's trying to execute the correct pattern, there might be some cues, whatever. We might have had a deeper discussion. But as soon as there's any instinct to see the hip kick outside the line, what I love is in real time, he can prevent it from happening. Oh, I see it. Make the adjustments. It's not perfect. It's not smooth. It's not something that necessarily would function immediately on the golf course. But as we go further into what deliberate practice is, and we talk about quality, and we talk about high repetition here in a minute, I want this guy to have the best possible chance to expose to his brain a super high quality rep, because high repetition only works as if you're exposing your brain to the preferred pattern. Correct? So hopefully I painted the picture there. Did I answer your question on the specific activity?
No, I get the specific activity, and you made a nice segue into, I think, what the second component of deliberate practice is, right? High repetition?
Yes, right. So a concept I want to... It's not just high repetition, right? There's some specifics about this high repetition, right? So we like to talk about three zones. We talk about the comfort zone. We talk about the learning zone, and we talk about the panic zone. So comfort zone's pretty straightforward. You're doing something you're already good at. Well, let me tell you something. You're trying to excel. You're trying to get better. You're trying to heighten your ability, heighten your ceiling. Doing something you're already good at is not the best strategy, right? But if we go on the other end of the spectrum, this is called your panic zone. Now we've asked you to do something so damn challenging or requires so much damn thought that you kind of freak out. And it's like, ooh, you know, and you're like, yeah, I can't do this. And you've convinced yourself of that. You take a step back. Well, that's not productive either, right? I'll be honest. As a coach, I try to hover the panic zone as closely as I possibly can. Right in between those two is called your learning zone. So you're doing something that you're not good at. It's challenging. It requires effort. It requires you to be mentally engaged. But it's not impossible. It's not so overwhelming that you can't fathom the possibility of you doing it. But that's where the magic happens. So if you're about to produce something in high, high repetition, it's got to be in the learning zone. You got something to add?
So talking about like kind of the comfort zone, learning zone, panic zone, a nice kind of like visual for people, I guess, even though this isn't necessarily about motor patterns, but we'll tie it back in here in a second, would be like, if you're standing on a putting green and all you're doing is tapping in 1 foot putts all day, like you're really not learning anything there. You are 100% in that comfort zone. If you also tell yourself you're not going to leave until you make 10, 20 footers in a row, you're probably never going to get out of there and you're going to start freaking out because you're going to miss them all the time. But if you put yourself 6 feet away and say, all right, I'm going to make 10 in a row before I leave, you might not get it that first time around. You might not get it the second time around, but you will start to make those putts. And then when that gets easy, now this is where, you know, Joe talks about going closer to that panic zone. Now we add some break to that putt. Maybe now we move it to 8 feet, maybe move it to 10 feet, whatever. And the same thing goes with, you know, changing a motor pattern. And let's just make it really simple and say we're trying to take that super negative club path, turn it positive. Maybe right now we can only do it at 30 miles an hour. When that gets easy, when you're in that comfort zone at 30 miles an hour, bump to 35, 40, every once in a while, test it. All right, we're back up at 80 miles an hour and we're negative again. All right, we got to dial it back. Get back to something you can do. Keep pushing it.
All right. Well, I guess that kind of answered my question, but maybe not completely clearly. So going to the range, grabbing a couple of buckets of balls and just hitting those, that's a specific activity. I'm hitting golf balls and high repetition. If I'm going through two large buckets, I mean, that's a lot of repetition. I mean, is that kind of the same as hitting 1 foot putts or is that somewhere else?
No, even though we did discuss it, I think it's actually makes a lot of sense you brought it up because I can only imagine that a lot of our listeners may or may not have been thinking that. But yeah, I mean, it just depends. Let's unpack what a typical range session looks like. You go to the range, you grab yourself a bucket or two, throw them down, start hitting some balls. Maybe you warmed up, who knows? All right, maybe you start the session in a really solid rhythm and you're hitting some good shots and you're like, holy shit, today's a day. It's a good day, I'm feeling good. Then what happens? Well, you fall out of the routine, okay? Then you start hitting it poorly. We're like, all right, well, shoot, what am I doing? Well, let me try this. All right, well, that didn't work. All right, well, let me try this. And you just go down this huge list of God knows how many swing thoughts or objectives until maybe you find rhythm again, right? Maybe you do, maybe you don't. Better athletes, yeah, you'll probably stand a chance at finding it again. But for the lesser athletes, you know, you could end up, you know, finishing the session in a much worse state in which you started. So, and then the problem is people get done and they've emptied the two buckets and they're like, yeah, well, shit, I just allocated an hour and a half. Well, probably for them, they probably went machine gun and it was a little bit shorter than that. But point is, they left saying, hey, I practiced, I'm working hard, doing the right stuff. But that goes back to what we just discussed. Where were they probably, Tommy? Where were they practicing? What zone?
Comfort zone.
Yeah.
I want to work on the club that I like the most because by the time I leave that range session, I want to feel good when I leave that. I want to feel accomplished.
You know, the ironic part to all of that is, and we say this a lot, is, you know, the last place we ask our students to go when they first start a program with us?
Is that rhetorical or do you want me to actually know? Because it's the driving range.
100%, which is people are like, man, that's really weird. That's ironic, but I want to go put in the time. I want to practice. Well, hopefully through what we've said already and what we're going to continue to say, you'll have a better understanding of why we've come to that conclusion. All right, where are
so
we?
We've all been guilty of that before. You know, us all here sitting at the table as well included, just, you know, going out mindlessly hitting some golf balls. So we know that that's not the way to do it. But we've identified specific activity, hopefully identified by an expert, by a coach that can pinpoint what the cancer is, what needs to be handled first, and have a good spiral effect into some improvements in skill set. We have to do it at a high repetition. So what are the other components? What's next?
All right. So number three, and arguably one of the most crucial, right? And this is called continuous feedback. Now, you've heard me say probably on other episodes, and we'll say in the future, but feedback, we probably just need to do an episode on all by itself because it's such a lengthy conversation. But, you know, in order to us to fully discuss deliberate practice, I'm just going to talk about it somewhat on a cursory level. But feedback, number one, it has to align with the objective, right? And so, like, for example, if we're back to the sway again, and we've determined that's our goal to improve the sway so you can properly rotate internally into the trail hip, well, what do you guys think is an appropriate piece of feedback if that's what we're working on? What do you think, Kyle? I mean, you know the answer.
Yeah, you got that ball against the wall. You got that, you know, line drawn on the live video.
Okay, so then moving forward, what most importantly probably shouldn't be the feedback?
Probably that golf ball.
Why?
Because honestly, the golf ball doesn't tell you if you're swaying or not. And if all our goal is to not sway, then who cares where the golf ball goes? Now, I know that's hard for a lot of people, but like when you're trying to change a motor pattern, the only thing that matters is changing the motor pattern, not where the golf ball goes. And that will eventually come down the line.
Love it. And that's well said. That comes down to a couple, you know, labels that we put on feedback, and it's either performance feedback or results feedback. Well, if we're working on the sway, we're concerned more of the performance, more of the movement. And that's where the live video and the environment of being inside of a hitting bay can be so beneficial because you're not emotionally impacted on whether or not you hit that ball solid or not, because it really doesn't matter. Okay. And I think, you know, without going super deep, because we're not going to do it today, about our timing equation, our philosophy mechanically, people might not be able to fully wrap their head around why we don't care about the ball early on. But I think as we jump into an episode on the timing equation, stay tuned to that, because that's going to be an awesome one that'll help clarify why that's a critical piece.
But I think you helped clarify why just going to the driving range and hitting golf balls is not the best place when people come in here initially, because they don't have that feedback that they need to tell them whether or not they're doing things correctly. All they have is, you know, perhaps their divot pattern and that ball flight, and those aren't, you know, real clear indicators as to whether or not you might be swaying, like Kyle just said. So
no, I agree. I just think sometimes the knee-jerk reaction is, okay, well, if I'm working on it and I've accomplished it and I've executed and it worked, why wasn't the shot immediately better? And it's not always that simple, because sometimes we're working on the route to a bigger issue and we've got to correct it from the start before we get to the biggest issue at hand, so we don't have to worry about that initial breakdown interfering with the development we've made later on in the story. So just to paint a picture about continuous feedback and about how I love live video, going back to this way, we're literally giving it to them, not just every single rep, but literally during the rep. We talked about high repetition, but the high repetition only creates an ROI if the repetition is exactly what you're trying to execute. So with the live video being so powerful, so if you're practicing and changing your golf swing and you're not using video, I can't wrap my head around that. Because here we are in the moment, like I said earlier, I corrected it. You can literally, in the beginning, be a beginner. This could be such a foreign move for you. But start exposing your brain to exactly what we need to immediately with the power of live video. So you can come in, spend that 30 minutes to an hour practicing, and know for a fact that your quality was high. And that's key. That is key. That if you're going to be doing the high repetition, which is a necessary ingredient, well, it better be exactly what you're trying to do.
All right. We got specific activity. We've got high repetition. You definitely made your point there that we need, you know, continuous feedback and the different types of feedback. Let's move on to the next point or two.
So the last two, I think, go hand in hand. And I think they're a direct result if you are executing steps 1 through 3 correctly, right? And they're simple. And one of them, it's mentally exhausting. And number two, it's not very fun.
Sounds awesome.
Yeah, it sounds great. Sign me up. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, let's face it. I mean, deliberate practice is truly, and it's an immense effort of focus and concentration. Listen, what's fun is doing something that we're good at, that's enjoyable. Deliberate practice is literally the opposite, right? And you laugh, and people, you know,
doesn't
go ahead,
sound
I'll
like
interrupt
a real
you.
Good sales pitch if we're trying to get people to come on in.
I get it, you know, and you're kind of jumping ahead to a point I was going to make later, but I honestly think if you think about this correctly, it should bring a little bit of peace of mind. Yes, you can know that, you know, listen, if it were easy, everybody would do it, right? And you can take consolation in the fact that that's just going to allow you to separate yourself even more from the masses, right? If it were easy, everybody would do it. And that's why there's so few and far between of people that excel so much in their discipline, not just, you know, world class, but even being a scratch golfer. I mean, we all know that's a massive accomplishment. I can promise you it wasn't because they were born with talent and they woke up one day and were good at it.
So, like, is there a recommendation on how long a practice session or a deliberate practice session should be? Or
I'll let Kyle talk about this.
So in this book, Talent is Overrated, they mentioned that the top performers only have like a mental capacity for like true deliberate practice for about 45 minutes. And these are people that have dedicated their life to whatever their craft is. So if you come in to this golf lesson or practice session thinking that you are going to be able to practice deliberately for 2 hours, you are wrong, for lack of a better term. So what I personally like to do is do it in small sections, like 5-10 minutes of very deliberate practice, and then take a 2-3 minute break and just take a couple full swings, like let your brain clear out for a second. But yeah, if you're trying to like power through for 2 hours, you are going to see a huge deterioration in the quality of your practice. So like on a personal note, I noticed I made my biggest improvements when I was very, very busy. And the only time I had to practice or hit balls was when a guy was like stuck in traffic and running 5-6 minutes late. Because I had 5 minutes, I could do 4 or 5 very deliberate reps, and I was done. Versus when I have an hour, you know, the first 20, 30 minutes are really good. And then I get in that same pattern that everybody else gets into, or I'm just like slapping away at it. So condense it, do it more frequently, but for way less time. And again, obviously much more deliberately.
What story does that remind you of? 5 minutes a day, all the time, every day.
Is that the reverse handlebar story? Yeah,
exactly. Well said. Thank you for sharing.
I mean, that kind of covers it, right?
Yeah.
I think we're there. Five elements of deliberate practice. I mean, are there other examples or anything that, you know, we want to share with audience about, you know, how deliberate practice challenges that notion further of innate talent or talent being born?
Yeah, there's a couple examples I want to cherry pick for sure. I was just going to say, I lost my train of thought, but now I remembered. I was just going to challenge listeners and students. If you find yourself with the ability to practice 2 hours, no problem, take a hard look at your quality of practice. Because if you're truly there working on it accordingly, like 2 hours is damn near impossible. Now, and I'm not saying you can't hit balls for 2 hours. That's a different style of practice. That's honing in. You know, like you look at someone that's already, call it, gotten their golf to it, or look at someone that had achieved satisfaction or gotten their, is gotten a word?
Gotten, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Or gotten their swing pattern to a preferred place. Well, yeah, go rep that out. Go rep it out.
One other thing I would say to that is, like, if you are going to practice for 2 hours, like, mix it up. You know, work on whatever motor pattern is for 20, 30 minutes, yeah, and then go hit the putting green. Go do some short game. Like, go work on drive a little bit. If you mix it up, like, you can be deliberate for 20 minutes in each of those different facets of the game, and it won't feel like as much of a grind as if you're working on sway for 90 minutes in a row. Like, that's brutal.
Correct.
But that also, like, leads to, like, blocked versus random practice as well, right?
Exactly.
It's easy to scrape a ball over, and you keep on doing the same thing. The example we like to use for that is, if I ask you guys, I mean, you're smart guys, but what's 1 plus 1?
2.
All right. What's 1 plus 1?
2.
1 plus 1?
2.
So the first time I asked you that, even though you knew what the answer was to that very simple, you know, math problem, your brain still had to run the program for it. But if I keep on asking you the same thing over and over, i.e. hitting your 7-iron over and over and just scraping a ball over, your body's not having to go through that. So that's why it's important to point out that, you know, a deliberate practice program is necessary to really get better at those things that you've identified you need to work on, but you also have to go through the routine of going through it, and that's what takes the more time to go through it. So you're going through that full process, going through your pre-shot routine, setting up, going through a few checkpoints there, and then working on that drill that you're working on deliberately for a period of time.
I'm really proud that you immediately went to block and variable practice there. You hit the nail on the head.
Thanks. I'm not just good looks, so I got a little bit to offer.
Okay, so back to the question. He says, is there anything else that I want to share that kind of makes a case that deliberate practice has a little bit more of an impact than talent? So, you know, one story that stuck with me from the book was about a famous table tennis player. His name was Desmond Douglas. And, you know, obviously, if you're a successful or professional table tennis player, you've probably got good eye-hand coordination and probably really good reaction time. What's cool is, you know, he was part of the research, and they had actually tested him across a number of different fields and activities, specifically his reaction time. And what they discovered was his reaction time on everything they tested outside of table tennis was average or below. And the one area and where it excelled was table tennis, right? So was he just born with the table tennis gene? What do we got, like 20,000 genes? I don't think they've been able to prove whether or not we can be born with specific sport genes, but I think that's a pretty good piece of evidence that, you know, through his long history of one particular activity, one particular discipline, he was able to train that skill set specific to that activity. You know, taking it a little deeper, I'm going to try to sound smart for a second. You know, the book also, well, actually, I don't even know if it was from this book, but it unpacks, if you look at the brain as a whole, right? And I'm not going to pretend like I know every piece and part of the brain, but there's something called the hippocampus. And that's, you know, mostly known for, you know, where we, you know, retain memory, where we get information, knowledge, words, okay? You know, another part of that is called the neocortex. And that's more known to be responsible for motor function. So again, you look at some of the stages of a motor pattern, which we've talked about in a previous episode, cognitive stage, receive information, maybe the hippocampus, okay? Now we've got associative stage, motor control, working on it, okay? Maybe that's the neocortex. But the point I want to make is when you've worked on something long enough, it actually moves into the cerebellum, where that's where they say, people, you know, incorrectly say, but that's where people, that's where muscle memory is, right? That's where things become instinctive and reactionary, right? So, and that would be what? Autonomous stage, right? So literally plays a role in that. And the reason I want to bring that up is I think it's, this is the point. Beginners literally are using a different part of their brain than experts, right? That's not talent. There's actually direct science that supports that. And in order to get that habit, that motor function into the cerebellum, it requires work.
Deliberate practice.
Exactly.
So we already touched on the fact that, I mean, early on, as we were going through some of those steps, it seemed like, you know, all right, it's not fun. It's mentally exhausting as a deterrent. You already talked about the fact that, you know, for those that have, you know, perhaps one other, you know, key indicator, not necessarily part of those five elements of deliberate practice, you know, might find some consolation in the fact that if somebody's more motivated than the other person, that would definitely, you know, be what sets them apart. You know, they've got this plan in place. They understand what the components of deliberate practice are. But if I know that, you know, if I work harder because a lot of people aren't going to go through these steps because some of them suck, then, you know, I'm going to grind even harder.
Yeah, I would say it should not function as a deterrent, knowing that it requires hard work. It should actually be peace of mind, because there's a lot of evidence saying, well, hey, I can't use the excuse that I'm just not capable. I can't use the excuse that I wasn't born with the necessary talent. Holy crap, you're telling me that there's actually evidence that if I actually put in the correct amount and in correct type of work, I stand a chance at becoming pretty darn good at something? Like, that's good news. Right now, not everyone's all equal, right? And there's going to be a future episode talking about the 11 characteristics and the rate of development, which will play a role into what we've discussed today. But the point is, yeah, through hard work, there's actually some pretty black and white objective evidence that says, yes, if you deliberate practice accordingly with an expert, you can get pretty good at something.
So like anybody, like, does this work for anybody? I mean, we cherry pick some pretty unique individuals here. We picked out Wolfgang, we picked out Eldridge, and the fact that, yes, they were exposed to some things early and their practice was very, very deliberate in nature. But how about those guys just trying to break a hundo? Does it work for those guys?
Short answer, 100%. But to your point, yes, deliberate practice is commonly associated with elite performers aiming for mastery. I totally get that. But, you know, even individuals with the most modest of goals, not saying that breaking 100 is modest, but it's definitely modest relative to becoming, you know, a tour professional. But the ingredients of deliberate practice are the ingredients. Those are the facts. Those aren't going to change. The reality is, if your goal is shy of what your potential is, well, then you can just stop attempting to get better when you've achieved that goal. But you guys have seen it time and time again. Yeah, their first goal might be to break 100. But what happens once they do?
On to 90. To 90.
Yeah. And then what happens when they do? Break 90.
Oof. Into 80.
Y'all, and guess what the good news is? Since you started attacking it correctly from the beginning, you're already engulfed in the routine and recipe that's going to take you there. Just keep going. Not to say that there's not modifications and evolution along the way, but that's the good news. And it's still, so yes, although you might not be trying to become world class, the recipe's the same.
The nice thing about like understanding deliberate practice and feedback and everything like that is I do think it gives, again, the guy who might be struggling a little bit more freedom to know that failure is okay and 100% part of the learning process.
Mindset episode, huh? We should probably do one of those.
Shameless plug.
Yeah, I mean, so listen, deliberate practice is one ingredient, but it's not the entire recipe, right? What's a recipe with only one ingredient? Okay, but you know, it is certainly
that guy's soup.
By Touché. The way,
did they write down what restaurant that one is? I want to make sure I cross that one off my list. I don't need to go to that one.
But as we've discussed time and time again, nothing supersedes the mindset, right? We just shared a lot of evidence today that whether or not you agree with talent is overrated or not, or whether or not you think it exists, you know, I'll be honest, like I don't know. I have three kids now, and I will say my perspective on that has changed a little. Not a lot, but a little. The point is that no matter how talented you are, talent without hard work doesn't matter, right? If you do believe that it does exist. But if one truly doesn't believe in the evidence being presented here on the concept, well, then that does bring us back to what is number one. And that is your mindset, right? You need to believe in this. You need to have a complementary mindset, which is a topic that we have mentioned, but that we are going to truly discuss in depth on a future episode. And I think we'll go, again, hand in hand. Like we've always said, all of our readings, all of our required readings tie in with each other, right? And they don't work alone. They work together. And I think what we have found by presenting them in the manner in which we have, it really resonates with our students. And with that knowledge, with that education, makes them really powerful. And it makes them a really, really good student. So again, that goes back to points we've made in the past. Like, we don't just automatically get good students. We cultivate them.
All right. Well, I think this was a spectacular episode. I mean, we covered a lot of things here. I mean, my brain's about to explode. Certainly explained why I didn't get any better at golf early on before learning about a lot of the things that we put into practice here. Like I said before, guilty as sin about going to the range, putting in a lot of hours, but not knowing what I was working on, just trying to groove a swing that was imperfect. So got any closing comments? Maybe a tip for the listeners?
Oof, everything but the tip.
Kyle, any closing thoughts?
Honestly, go read the book.
Yeah, go read the book. No, the book's fantastic. You know, I always joke with my wife that I read one book a year. I read in about 2 days. That was on the list a couple of years ago. So checked it off. No, honestly, be a little bit more strict with practice. Again, the whole thing is on deliberate practice. So beating balls is not going to get the job done. Go in with a plan and stick to the plan, even if things aren't going the way that you want them to, as long as you are accomplishing whatever task you set out to do. So if it looks better on video, if whatever training aid you're using or whatever is providing the feedback that you're doing on the right track, stick with it.
And use an expert to lay out that plan. I do have a tip.
Okay.
All right. No. Always, we got to leave the episode with a tip. I want to say, stop using your talent level or lack thereof as an excuse and just start putting in the work. Chances are you're more capable than you believe. That's all I got.
Wow. That was deep. That was deep. Definitely need the swim cap for that one. Well, thanks, fellas. Awesome time tonight.
Always a pleasure. All right. That was a good one. Cheers.
Till next time. Kippis.
A big thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Everything But the Tip podcast. Stay connected with us on all social media platforms by following @SmartGolfFitness. For additional episodes, updates, and exclusive content, check out our website at smartgolffitness.com. Don't forget to show some love, like, share, and subscribe to ensure you never miss out on the latest insights and engaging discussions. Your support means the world to us. Until next time, keep swinging and stay fit.